This is Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Wednesday, March 17, 2021. St. Patrick's Day, Taylor Schwenk, who produced this podcast from his home studio in the foothills of Connecticut. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. What do you do on St. Patrick's Day? Anything special?
No, not really. Maybe in my younger years, I would have hit up a pub for some green beer, but I am like thoroughly a Euro mutt, so I don't have any strong Irish ties like I know a lot of people do. What about you?
I do. I think I'm something like 75% Irish, but I don't know. My question is this, and it's like one of those philosophical questions. If you have terrible red-green color blindness and you're Irish, how should you handle St. Patrick's Day?
Wow. Have you ever been to Ireland? I feel like you would be driving around seeing fields of gray. Is that what you see instead of green
and
red?
No, that's not what I see. I would definitely see, especially in spring. You see, so I can see really bright colors. I can see a bright green, but I do have really bad red-green color blindness.
Got it.
So, yeah, but we've got a lot of questions. One of the ones we're going to try to answer today is, who won the bet between Taylor and I over whether or not Tim had knowledge of the Royals? And we're going to be asking Tim about that during today's podcast. News and notes from yesterday, LeBron James has become a part owner of the Boston Red Sox. This was first reported by the Boston Globe and confirmed by ESPN. James and business partner Maverick Carter are now partners at Fenway Sports Group. Sources confirmed to ESPN with the stake, they become partial owners of other FSG subsidiaries, including Liverpool Football Club, Roush Fenway Racing, and Nesson. The Detroit Tigers' Miguel Cabrera doesn't believe that the Astros' 2017 title is tainted, and he supports the hiring of manager A.J. Hinch. He said to ESPN, "That's BS. I don't care about that." The Baltimore Orioles finalized a one-year, $800,000 deal with Michael Franco. Toronto Blue Jays right-hander Nate Pearson aggravated a strained right groin. That's kind of a big deal. Like, he's an important part of what they're going to be trying to do this year. Pete Alonso had a nice moment among many nice moments this spring in the Mets exhibition on Tuesday.
Alonso hammers one toward the left field corner. That ball is deep, and it's gone. A home run for Pete Alonso. He continues to crush the baseball this spring. A double and a homer today as the Mets now lead 4-1.
Jacob DeGrom, in that game, had his fastball velocity up to 102 miles per hour. We're going to be talking later in the podcast with Paul Ambakides about Mr. DeGrom. Shohei Ohtani, we've been talking him up on the podcast, and every day he seems to do something to justify that.
Ohtani skies it to center field. Way back, sayonara, Shohei. What a shot. Again, over the batter's eye, 9-2 Angels here in the third.
Trevor Bauer was out on the mound for the Dodgers, and he looked great.
Here's a 3-2. Payoff pitch, caught and missed. Strike three, and Jackie Bradley Jr. goes down on strikes. Trevor Bauer pumping that one right past him. Like that, that'll build a little morale.
Yeah, it doesn't matter if one eye's open or both of them are open. That's gas. 10-1, David Bassett, delighted for him.
A swing and a miss as he chased the curveball. That was a vicious curveball by Bauer. He strikes off the mound. Strike three. He just caught Travis Shaw watching the paint dry.
Tim Nebert, Rick Monday on the Dodgers television network with those calls. Now, before we get to Dave Schoenfield, to Hembo, to Tim, and to Steve Sparks, as we continue our American League West previews, he's going to talk with us about the Houston Astros. First, check out America's Caddy on ESPN Plus, hosted by Michael Collins. Join the quick-witted longtime caddy, comedian, and ESPN golf analyst, and he's great. I love listening to him, as he interviews the biggest stars in the game. America's Caddy is part travelogue, part golf history lesson, part celebrity hangout, and full of laughs. Streaming now on ESPN Plus. Also, big news for the right time with Bomani Jones. Bo is bringing you new podcasts Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays. That's right, three podcasts a week, every week. And Fridays are officially hashtag Foxworth Fridays with Dominique Foxworth riding shotgun with Bo. Listen to the right time with Bomani Jones. Mondays, Wednesdays, and Fridays, wherever you get your podcasts.
You can now stream the most MLB games on DirecTV without a satellite dish.
Yes, the clutch hits, the strikeouts, grand salamis, web gems, with nothing on your roof.
So whoever's up there, whether it's roofers, Santa, birds, old-timey chimney sweeps, moody teenagers, thrill-seeking raccoons, you name it, they won't find a satellite dish. But you will find your MLB games on DirecTV. That means DirecTV is your home for baseball this season. Root, root, root with nothing on your roof. Call 1-800-DIRECTV or visit DirecTV.com. Sign up today. Claim based on total games carried on sports networks. Sports availability varies by zip code and requires choice package. Vivid Seats wants to get you to the games you love this spring. Experience every pitch, assist, and game-winning shot live and in person. And the best part? Each transaction is a step toward a free 11th ticket with Vivid Seats rewards. Score unbeatable perks like free tickets, surprise seat upgrades, and annual birthday deals. As the official ticketing partner of ESPN, Vivid Seats is offering you $20 off your first $200 ticket purchase with code BASEBALL. That's code BASEBALL. Visit VividSeats.com or download the app today. Vivid Seats. Experience it live.
Welcome to the show!
Welcome to the show.
Welcome to the show, mate.
Welcome to the show. Whoa!
Welcome to the show, baby.
You're in the show with David Schoenfeld.
And David Schoenfeld covers baseball for ESPN. And Dave, yesterday we got word, LeBron James buying into the Boston Red Sox. What was your gut reaction when you first heard it? Because I definitely have some thoughts.
Well, my gut reaction was I thought he was a Yankees fan. And I remember him wearing a Dodgers cap, you know, during the playoffs last year. So he's going to have to figure out his allegiances here if he's going to be a part owner of the Red Sox.
Yeah, we've seen all sides of LeBron when it comes to being a baseball fan. I remember covering the Indians playing the Red Sox in 2016. And, you know, there was a question whether or not some of the Cavs would come over and watch the Indians play. And during the course of one game, LeBron and some of the other guys made it over, and it was got a huge response in the ballpark. And then as the Indians went through that postseason, advancing all the way to Game 7 of the World Series, LeBron James would make appearances. And then that conversation you just cited came up. Wait, I thought he was a Yankee fan.
But, well, you know, I know a baseball team in Cleveland that could maybe use a new owner who might be willing to spend a little money. So maybe LeBron can learn how baseball operates as a part owner of the Red Sox. And then when he retires from the NBA, buy the Cleveland baseball team, LeBron, and spend some money.
You know, I never that never even popped into my mind yesterday when I saw that. You're right. He gets into the club. Right. He's approved as a part owner of the Red Sox. And then he shifts. We've seen, I mean, John Henry did that.
Yeah. You know,
John Henry was the owner of the Marlins. And then he wound up essentially flipping that ownership or part of that ownership over to owning the Red Sox. Once he got in the club that he could move, LeBron would be great. But I would say this. I mean, we've seen LeBron in his NBA career. He's pretty pliable. Right. As the needs fit, you know, he'll go from the Cavs to the Heat, back to the Cavs and the Lakers, you know, as his life demands. And I suspect he's probably that way with his baseball allegiances. And I also wonder, given his competitive instincts, if he would enjoy being the owner of the Cleveland baseball franchise, given the limitations that they have. Because I don't see him being like a Mike Ilitch type owner where he's just willing to spend money out of hand, out of his own pocket in order to give them a chance to win. What do you think?
No, I think like most owners, he would prefer it to be a profitable enterprise. But hey, look, you know, we're kind of laughing at this, but it's a good little thing for baseball. Bring some attention to the sport. I know LeBron has said, you know, he wants to long term own an NBA team. NBA rules prohibit him from buying in while he's an active player. So, look, realistically, you know, that's more likely than him taking full share of a baseball team. But I'm pretty sure he has the money to buy into whatever franchise he would like down the road.
Yeah, no doubt about it. And I am absolutely excited by the possibility of him potentially, you know, becoming a presence in baseball as an owner. And I'll tell you why. Because it really does feel like right now that the two sides, the owners and the players, are as entrenched as they've ever been on both sides. And we've seen LeBron James come out and support players and social baseball players and social media over, you know, issues that they're having with Major League Baseball. And I like, besides the fact, baseball clearly needs more minority owners, you know, African-Americans, Latinos, et cetera. And I think that, you know, that for starters, that's really important for baseball. But I also think it's important for baseball that you potentially have somebody who's like a new, he's like a new sheriff in town. He's an honest broker. He's coming into this. And if he actually gets involved in this, maybe he can shake things up. You know, maybe he can change the equation a little bit.
Yeah, that's a great point. And look, there's no doubt LeBron has whatever you want to call it, the it factor, the cool factor that maybe gets younger people paying a little more attention to baseball. You know, I know a different generation, but it certainly doesn't hurt when Magic Johnson, you know, is out there tweeting about the Dodgers, right? You know, bring some attention to the sport. And that's a good thing in the big picture.
Yep. No doubt about it. So, you know, as time goes on, we'll see how much control he gains. You and I talked beforehand. We don't know what percentage stake he has in the Red Sox. It could be 0.1%. You know, maybe eventually becomes a little bit more. There have been questions in baseball about whether or not, you know, in the next 10 years, the Red Sox are going to be sold and whether or not Theo Epstein or somebody like that might, you know, might get involved.
Yeah, and, you know, one last point, you know, baseball teams are becoming so expensive to buy. Having these single kind of ownership groups are going to be more and more difficult in the future. So you're going to have groups of people, right, buying baseball teams. You know, the old idea of one guy owning a team when they're worth, you know, the Red Sox, I don't know what they're worth, you know, a couple billion dollars at least, right? You know, there's only so many people with that kind of money who are interested in buying a baseball team.
The stories I read yesterday said that the Red Sox are considered by Forbes to be the third most valuable baseball franchise, one being the Yankees, two being the Dodgers, and three being the Red Sox. So LeBron is definitely starting near the top in his baseball ownership. Speaking of the Dodgers, Cody Bellinger this spring has debuted a new stance. He, of course, had right shoulder surgery after, you know, separating his shoulder again during the postseason last year when he was celebrating with a teammate, banging shoulders against somebody else. And so he had surgery and he came out yesterday in his batting stance and it was very different. It was more open. It's upright. It's just in keeping with what I think Cody Bellinger is a hitter. He's so unbelievably talented as an athlete, but it really does feel like hitting will always be something that will be a challenge for him.
Yeah, he's tinkered, you know, in the past with his stance. His career, he's been inconsistent, great as a rookie, not so great in 2018, MVP winner in 2019, struggled, you know, for him quite a bit last year. So this is another way just he's to try to develop some consistency and get back to that 2017 and 2019 level of play. And like you said, he's such an unbelievable athlete, you know, that I think even though he's tinkering, you don't normally recommend that. I think it could work for him.
Yeah, I think of someone like Buster Posey, you know, the stories I'd always hear from Hensley Mullins when Hensley Mullins was the Giants hitting coach about Buster Posey. He was had such an understanding of his swing and his stance and was all very simple. If he got a breaking ball, he would pull it. If he got a fastball, he hit it the opposite field. And his batting practice sessions, according to Hensley, were essentially he just would swing until it felt okay. And sometimes that would be like 10 to 15 swings and they'd be like, oh, I got it. Whereas Cody Bellinger reminds me a lot of a player I covered back in the 90s, Cal Ripken. And yep. That it's, you know, Cal Ripken wound up with over 3,000 hits in his career. He is a Hall of Famer, but hitting was not easy for him. And you look at Cody, as you said, tinkering all the time.
Yeah, and I know you grew up, I'm sure, watching Carly Yastrzemski. He was famous for changing his stance every year.
Right.
Again, there's not very many great players who are doing that, but, you know, we just named a couple, so it can work for him.
Yeah, do you think that Ken Griffey Jr. tinkered with his stance that much?
Yeah, I think Griffey had the same stance since he was 3 years old until his final day in the majors.
Yep, exactly. This was interesting. Dayton Moore, general manager of the Kansas City Royals, was talking with their old friend Jim Bowden, and said to him that the Royals are being open-minded about whether Bobby Witt Jr. could break camp with a big league team. This was in a conversation on Tuesday. Bobby Witt Jr. has really opened eyes with his long home runs this spring. He's a number 7 overall prospect on some lists, and some lists he's a little bit higher, some lists he's a little bit lower. So when I saw this, my first thought was, when Dayton Moore says something like this, you can take it at face value because he hasn't worried about service time manipulation. You know, he started Eric Hosmer and Mike Moustakas in their rookie seasons, you know, giving him an opportunity to play. And on the other hand, I also went back and you look, first off, when I looked at Bobby Witt Jr.'s spring training numbers, they kind of made me wince a little bit because the perception that's being put out there is that, you know, Witt Jr. is dominating spring training. 9 for 31, 2 walks, 9 strikeouts. That to me is not dominating spring training. The walks and strikeouts are always the first numbers that I look at. And I thought, yeah, he's obviously got a lot of swing and miss for a young player. And Dave, he's never played above rookie ball.
Yeah, that would be, and in modern baseball, unprecedented basically for a guy like that to jump to the majors. You know, I mean, among the current crop, Juan Soto is the exception. He only played 122 minor league games, only 8 above Class A. But you just mentioned that walk to strikeout ratio. He's nowhere near the disciplined and mature hitter that Juan Soto is. You know, going back, you know, there's a few college guys like John Olerud and Pete Incaviglia, Bob Horner, who jumped straight to the majors. The last guy I found who went from rookie ball to the majors was Robin Yount. 1974, drafted at 17, played that his first season of pro ball at rookie ball, and the next year at age 18 was the opening day shortstop for the Brewers, and he turned out pretty well. But like you said, Dayton Moore's talking about it. He's not dismissing it. The Royals don't really have a second baseman, so there is sort of a hole there that he could take. And maybe they want to just have him get at bats for a month before the minor league season starts and send him down. But yeah, it's an interesting idea.
Yeah. And they do have some flexibility in that position. They're waiting for someone to grab second base by the throat. And so maybe someone will do that. I will say this. It's funny as you made that, you know, reference to Robin Yount. I do weekly radio appearance in Kansas City on every Thursday morning. And the two hosts, Stephen St. John, Nate Buchady, were talking last week about their conversations with Mike Boddicker, the longtime pitcher of the Baltimore Orioles, and George Brett, the Hall of Famer. And both of those guys mentioned to them, well, you know who Bobby Witt Jr. reminds us a lot of? Robin Yount. So it's funny. It's exactly that type of player who's going to make a jump like this. I still think that while Dayton is going to be open-minded, my guess is that he's going to want at least to give Bobby Witt Jr. some at-bats in the minor leagues. What about Jared Kelnick? What do you think? How do you think the Mariners are going to handle him?
Yeah, that'll be fascinating. You know, he's been injured. I think he might return today. He's roaring to get back in the lineup. You know, he only has 21 games above Class A. Throw out manipulating the service time. Is he ready for the major leagues? You know, he didn't play last year. Sorry. The summer camp, you know, that's not a substitute for real game action. You know, only 173 minor league games. Look, Ronald Acuna, 259 games in the minors, 134 above Class A. So he basically had a full season of action above Class A, where Kelnick has 21. Carlos Correa played 53 games above Class A. Bryce Harper, 58. You know, and these are the best, the cream of the crop. And when you compare Kelnick's minor league stats to those guys, they're not quite as good. You know, there's not any indication that he's going to be the next, you know, Ronald Acuna as a hitter. He might be. The minor league stats aren't quite as impressive, although impressive. So I know baseball Twitter wants him on the opening day roster. I think he needs time in the minors. But again, what's he doing in April if he's not in the major leagues?
All right. Andrew Vaughn of the White Sox, Wander Franco of the Tampa Bay Rays.
Yeah. Two other guys who haven't played above Class A. Franco, you know, they already sent him down to the minor league camp the other day. he'll be up, I'm sure, at some point in the season. Same thing. Get him a couple months, you know, at double A or triple A. Andrew Vaughn, I think he might make that roster. We've talked about him, I think, because he has that plate discipline that's so important. Very good walk to strikeout ratio so far in spring training. I think it's even. His walk rate in college was off the charts. He, you know, plus he's an older player. I know hasn't played above Class A. That one would not shock me if he's on the roster.
Yeah, this spring, again, you know, he's not absolutely dominating spring training, but six walks and eight strikeouts, which reflects some plate discipline. And I've told the story in the podcast before about how, in talking with White Sox people, you know, the question of whether or not you'd want to devote a young player to a lot of at bats, a designated hitter, the White Sox are very comfortable with Andrew Vaughn doing that because they feel like that he's such a mature hitter and he's such a mature person that he's someone who would adapt to a role like that.
Yeah, I think so. And again, you know, the statistical record says this guy's a pretty advanced hitter, and everything you're saying, you hear about his demeanor, his maturity, he's not going to get overwhelmed. And look, he comes up, he struggles for a month. Okay, send him back down to AAA. You know, I think he's good enough where that's not going to happen. But there's clearly an opening. They don't have a DH. I don't know who their other DH option would be. Zach Collins, maybe, you know. So, again, you know, they're waiting for him to take that role and run with it.
All right, Dave, thanks for doing this. I greatly appreciate it.
All right, you bet, Buster.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin, or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Jumping into the numbers. This is Hembo Knows on Baseball Tonight.
And Hembo is Paul Imbecchietti. He's a researcher at ESPN, and of course is a honcho on the show Get Up. He tells us he's the head honcho. Mike Greenberg strongly disagrees with that and just talks about how much Hembo actually parties.
Oh, Hembo. Yeah.
All right, Hembo. So you help me out a lot when it comes to my Sunday column and preparing for Sunday Night Baseball, getting ready for the podcast. And I reached out to you last week with an idea in trying to really reveal all of the great things or the great aspects about what Juan Soto does at the plate. And I mentioned to you that I thought a great way to do that might be how many swings and misses, you know, his swings, the number of swings he takes relative to the damage that he does. So it was, you know, swings and misses versus total bases.
Right.
I mean, that stat, the crust quotient, has gotten great reception from folks around.
Oh, great.
Baseball.
Oh.
Yeah. I mean, I've a lot of people have reached out, and they said they absolutely love it because, A, it's really simple, but, B, it really seems to get to the heart of who's great and who's terrible.
That's right. Move aside, Bill James. Buster Olney is the new foremost statistician around baseball. So the way that we did this was we took total bases divided by the number of swings, and we just multiplied that by 100 just so that the numbers are, you know, recognizable and not decimals. And because total swings is the denominator, it's a stat that penalizes players who swing and miss a lot and thus rewards players who don't. And that's something that no other outcome-based stat like this can do. And because total bases is the numerator, the top, you know, the top on the division, it penalizes players without power and rewards players who have it. So what it essentially spits out, Buster, is a list of the players that best blend bat-to-ball skills with power, which is really the holy grail in today's game. And you asked me to look up stuff over the last 3 years. The top four in this metric are Mike Trout, Mookie Betts, Alex Bregman, and Christian Yelich. So you know you have a good stat when those are the top four players on it.
Yeah, one of the guys who did well last year in that statistic was Will Myers, the San Diego Padres, and he's had an ups and downs throughout his career. And you and I were going back and forth in email about, you know, his emergence on this particular statistic. And I felt like, you know what? I need to go back and take a closer look at Will Myers, and maybe he has turned the corner, as players tend to do, some players tend to do during the course of their careers, because to show up high in a ranking of this particular statistic really demonstrates some acumen.
It demonstrates that you have multiple things that are required to be a great hitter, which might suggest that he's on his way to bigger and better things, like sort of the traditional story of one of these post-hype sleepers. Like, you know, we've always known he has the talent. He was a top prospect for years and has flashed it. Perhaps it just demonstrates that he had a career year in a shortened season and he might regress. But anytime a player like him shows up on a leaderboard like this, I'm with you. I want to ask myself more questions as to, you know, why he's there and what I might be missing.
All right. Give me some established players who fared really badly in this number.
This is a fascinating case study that you asked me to do. So I look back over the last three seasons again to get a representative sample size. I have a handful of names of guys that surprised me or at least stuck out. One of whom was James McCann, who ranked in the 23rd percentile of the statistic. Mm-hmm. He just got $50 million for the Mets. So that's a player whose track record as being a great player is super small. So we'll see if he can live up to that deal, but he's going to have to hit to come close to justifying it. Brandon Beltbuster ranked only in the 33rd percentile during that span. He's coming off of a career year, but it made me think to myself, well, maybe, just maybe, 2020 was a mirage. Miguel Cabrera ranked only in the 36th percentile, which might not be surprising considering, I guess in some sense, he has shown a lot of regression. But this is a number that indicates to me, as he's sort of chasing 3,000 hits and 500 home runs, we should pay a lot of attention to his quality of contact because it has clearly not been there the last 3 years. And he was a player for whom years before this, he would have ranked at the very top of these leaderboards. Two more names for you. Andrew Benintendi ranked only in the 37th percentile. I asked myself at the time, why in the world would the Red Sox trade him for what felt like 50 cents on the dollar? Well, maybe they have other numbers like this that suggest this is a player who's come close to hitting his ceiling. And lastly, and perhaps most surprisingly, Bryce Harper ranked only in the 55th percentile, about average. This is a player who had more walks than strikeouts last year. And obviously this surprised me to a great deal as someone who watches most Phillies games. But over the previous two seasons, as you know, a lot of swing and miss issues. So I'm very curious to see if Bryce Harper in 2021 is going to be more the player he was last year or more the player he was in the previous 2 years, which is to say a genuinely great hitter or just a pretty good hitter that probably can't quite live up to the contract that they signed him to.
I got to tell you, and I'll give you a theory on this, why Bryce Harper shows up on this, is I thought about this statistic. I thought the one hole in it is not accounting for the hitter whose plan is to essentially guess once or twice during an at-bat, where he's going to say, you know what, I am going to let it fly because I'm looking to do damage. And we know how hard Bryce Harper swings. And maybe he has a high number of those where he, on the first pitch, he's going to sit on a particular pitch in a particular area and just let it go. So he's going to have more swing and miss. That's totally fair.
Yeah, that's totally fair because we don't discriminate based upon the count. But what we could easily do, Buster, is divide total bases, divided by swings on two strikes. And we could, in that way, or early in the count, for example,
dig a little bit further,
correct, to see which hitters are totally willing to sell out. It might be a statistic that we could sort of split even further to gain even more clarity.
And I got to tell you, James McCann's inclusion on that, what I heard a lot of during the wintertime is people talked about with other teams about what the Mets did this winter. They feel like that if the Mets could do it all over again, they should have gone in the eyes of a lot of folks with other teams, all in JT Realmuto. Rather than, in other words, overspend on an all-star, the preeminent catcher in baseball, rather than potentially overspend on James McCann. I actually understand why the Mets did what they did. They wanted to address an important position, but a lot of the questions that I've heard from folks with other teams is, boy, James McCann doesn't have a lot with the bat, especially against right-handed pitchers.
So yeah, it doesn't surprise me at all. Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think you can get James McCann for 75% less most years if you can identify the player who might be sort of on the up and up, rather than sort of pay 100 cents on the dollar for a player who does not have the track record like JT Realmuto does.
Right. Exactly. All right. We've been talking so much about March Madness this week, so we're going to go with the March Madness theme. For some categories. You sent these along to me, and I'm fascinated by this. The number one overall seed in baseball, and I will tell you right now, if you don't come up with the answer that everyone knows, the Gonzaga of baseball, you might be kicked off the podcast.
Buster, everyone knows that the Gonzaga of baseball is the Dodgers. They're over-under at Caesars William Hill is 103.5 right now, which is the highest preseason total by any team since the 1999 Yankees. But they played on a 116-win pace last year. Would you take the Dodgers or the field in the National League? Because I know you'll take the over with that 103.5.
I would take the Dodgers, and I would take the
okay. Over. Fair yep. enough. Right now, Gonzaga has something like a 1-in-4 chance to win the whole thing. You think anytime you're taking a team over all the other teams, they're a prohibitive favorite. But it sounds like you see him as such
in the National League. Yeah.
Okay.
In the National League. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Knowing that if they win the National League West, which I think they will, that makes the road a little bit more difficult for the Padres to navigate through. If in fact they're the second best team in baseball.
No doubt.
Cinderella.
My Cinderella, Buster, a team that I could see reaching the World Series that no one expects, is the Blue Jays. And I'll tell you why. They were one of three teams in the American League last year that averaged 5 runs a game. They did so with the youngest lineup in all of baseball and have since added George Springer. I think if they can pitch enough, they can make a real run and supplant the Rays at minimum as the second best team in that division. What say you?
No. 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 No, not the World Series. You tell me they win the division. I think that's within the realm of possibility. Yankees get some injuries, pull them back to the pack, some other things go well. But in terms of having the pitching to get all the way to the World Series, I just don't see it. So you're wrong on that one. You're diaper dandy.
My diaper dandy is Christian Pache. He's in line to be the Braves opening day center fielder at the age of 22, as we know. We also know that he can run. We know that he can throw, and we know that he can go get it in the outfield. And I will say this. I think his bat flashed last year in the NLCS and will play up enough to make him baseball's best rookie this season. There's not a great statistical profile for him, but the tools are there. Like, he's got tools coming out of his ears. I say Pache will be the best rookie in baseball this season.
No.
Who do you like instead?
And first off, I really like him as a player, but just about him in particular –
yeah,
I remember watching him during the postseason last year and thinking that a great comp might be Andrelton Simmons. And where Andrelton Simmons clearly at the outset of his career was a dominant defensive player. And then I'd ask the Braves about his offense. And they go, no.
Okay.
like they felt like that he was always going to be someone who's going to struggle somewhat offensively. And I'm not a professional in terms of being an evaluator on swings. But it jumped out at me that there was a lot of imprecision there in what he was trying to do. We'll see. Yeah, he's a young player as well. Okay, most outstanding player.
The most outstanding player in baseball this season will be Jacob DeGrom. In his age of 30 through 32 seasons, he generated an ERA, Buster, that was adjusted 88% above the league average. That ranks first all time, right ahead of Lefty Grove, Walter Johnson, and Greg Maddux. And the reason I believe that he is poised for his best season yet, aside from the absurd stuff that he's showing in spring training, of course, it's his workload thus far. He's only at 1,100 and some career innings, Buster. Jacob DeGrom has thrown fewer innings in his big league career than Babe Ruth did. This is a player right now in the thick of his prime, and for my money, is absolutely on a Hall of Fame track and is going to have the kind of season this year that will be the stuff of legend.
I agree with you 100%. I watched him pitch yesterday. I've actually been working on some stuff. He's going to be pitching on opening day. On our first broadcast when the Mets play the Nationals, he is ridiculous right now and how great he is. But I want to dig into that. I'm going to send you some emails later today as I had some things I'm going
to
be working on. So
looking
thanks
forward
for
to
that
it.
In advance, and thanks for everything. I hope you don't take our insults of you personally.
Later, boys.
Get out of here, Hembo. Sick
exactly
of Hembo.
Right.
Steve Sparks is an analyst on the radio side for the Houston Astros, having pitched 9 seasons in the big leagues. He's down in Florida. Before we started today, he started taunting me with that fact, and he told me about going running with Tony Robbins. What was that about?
I wasn't running with Tony Robbins. We were crossing paths, and I could tell from probably 60 yards away that it was actually Tony Robbins because he's 6'7". He's got a huge melon, and he actually, when he crossed me, he said, "Shallow Hal likes a gal." I don't know what that means, but that's what he said. So I'm sticking to it.
I was wondering if you're going to stop and get like life advice and you'd feel, and you probably ran like a 4-minute mile as you were finishing up after passing him, that sort of thing, you know?
Well, I need it. Let's put it that way.
All right. What a difference a year makes as we move forward with the American League West previews. We'll talk about the Houston Astros. What a difference a year makes for the Astros. You know, a year ago, they had a bunch of reporters following around, you know, folks like myself, because of sign-stealing decisions and suspension and the firing of A.J. Hinch, the firing of Jeff Luhnow. And that's all in the past, the rearview mirror, I think, at least in terms of media. We'll see how fans react. But the biggest thing, tangibly, is the fact that George Springer's gone. Where do they make up? How do they make up for his production, his leadership?
I don't think they do, and I don't think any one person's going to do that. And Dusty Baker addressed that really early, and I think he's fiddling and he's messing around with the lineup to see who might fill that spot at the top of the lineup. That was a unique position that Springer was in at the top of the lineup. We didn't see a whole lot of that in the major leagues. We're starting to see a little more now, but the prototypical slap the ball around, get on base and steal a base or two and cause chaos on the base pass doesn't seem the way teams are going at a large degree right now. So the leadoff spots could either be Miles Straw, who figures to be the center fielder. They've fiddled with Carlos Correa at the top of the order. In the last couple of games, they've done it with Jose Altuve, who, of course, has done it in the past. And I think the only question mark for me is, okay, is Miles Straw going to hit enough to get on base to make a difference? Or does Altuve even want to hit at the top of the order? And he's pushed back a little bit in times past. I don't know if he likes that pressure to get on base or if it takes away his aggressiveness early in the counts, if that mindset hurts him in that fashion. But I think it makes the most sense to have Altuve at the top. But otherwise, I mean, as far as charisma and what he meant to the team and his leadership, you can't replace George Springer.
I feel like that a big part of trying to make up for his production has to come from Yordan Alvarez, who, you know, is maybe in a better place physically than where he was last year.
If you want to get really specific, okay, you put Alvarez in there, and he matters a lot. But there was a lot of players who underperformed last year who you expect to be much better this year. And I'm talking about Altuve, Correa, Bregman, and Gurriel. All four infielders had down years last year. I happen to believe that I think it had something to do with the psychology of the cheating scandal. And I think there was a lot of mixed emotions, maybe shame, embarrassment, and all those things rolled into one. And I think you throw on top of that all the protocols and what we went through with the pandemic, I don't think helped their mental state as well. But I'm with you. Alvarez makes a huge difference. He's only played in one game so far this spring. Looked okay. He looked a little ginger getting out of the box, I thought, but maybe that's more mental than it is physical at this point. I don't think he'd be on the field unless they felt like he was really ready to go. And I think they're doing the same thing with Bregman with his hamstring tweak.
So just to double back on something you just said about, you know, the sort of the psychology of the fallout from the sign stealing scandal. I told the story that I covered Roberto Alomar after the spitting incident. And I always thought that after that happened, I was covering him when it happened. And then afterward, I think that the joy kind of went out of Roberto to some degree. And I've wondered about that with the Astros. If last year just coming to the ballpark just wasn't as much fun, and maybe that's something that'll get better with time. What do you think?
I think it'll get better with time. And I think it was very real. And it was apparent to me anyway, who was at the ballpark for all their home games and could even see the body language in between what we saw on camera. And when they're taking infield in between innings, I saw a lifelessness, you know, with this team. And for the last 10 days of the season, I thought, man, this team, even if they make it into the playoffs, I mean, it's going to be so quick, but I'll be darned, man. That was part of the narrative, you know, on our television broadcast and our radio broadcast was, can this team turn on the switch? And I'll be darned if they didn't turn on the switch. They turned into that team that we'd seen for the last 5 years right before our eyes. We couldn't believe it. Couldn't believe the way the lifeless player, I mean, the guys that we thought, you know, were dead in the water last year, rise to the top. Altuve did, Correa did, Bregman did to an extent. So we started to see some of it. In the spring training this year, I think you want to talk about Altuve, and rightly so, with the throwing issues. Right now, he looks fantastic, and he put in a lot of work this offseason with Joe Espada, the infield coach for the Astros, was at Minute Maid Park working on his footwork and trying to clean up some of his bad habits as far as his throwing issues were concerned. And you know as well as I do, Buster, that stuff becomes more mental than it does physical at a certain point. And right now, everything looks really confident and very sure with the throws. His feet look like they're under him. You know how sometimes, you probably saw it with Knobloch and we saw it with Mackie Sasser and some of these players. You could almost see the wheels spinning in the guy's head. And right now, I don't see any hesitation mentally with Altuve as he throws.
And that's great to hear, because during the postseason last year, I just felt so bad for him, because knew he hated letting down his teammates. And my experience in watching Knobloch, and I'll never forget the first throw. It was in a spring training game in 98, and it was a regular throw from second base, and he launched it into the first base dugout, and everyone looked at it. He was a Gold Glove caliber second baseman. And it went in the dugout, and it was kind of a laugh, and then he did it again. And then it went away for a while. And then he made a bad throw, and then it came back. And it would kind of, come and go with the gaps in between, which is why, Chuck would go and work out, and he would throw the ball great, and he'd be fine for 2 months, and all of a sudden, boom, with one throw, it could come back. And that's what, fingers crossed for Jose, that he doesn't sort of have that the flashback, so to speak, and bring him back, and he could just move on past it, because he's, someone who cares desperately.
When you're talking about yips and golf or the throwing issues with anybody, you don't want to talk about it, because you want to get that as far back in the recesses of your brain as possible. So whether or not he was able to talk to somebody through that issue and gets everything off to the side, I think the best thing that's happened to him so far this spring is that it looks like he's squashed all the questions. That's what I was wondering right when we got here. What's he going to look like as he throws a baseball, and what that might mean? Is he going to be the center fielder? I started thinking, what can you do to keep Altuve out there? You've got him signed up for another 4 or 5 years. So I think getting some of those questions in the background right now is what's going to help him more than anything.
Yeah, and I do hope that he is talking to someone, a sports psychiatrist, sure, a performance coach, that sort of thing. I think the Yankees, in retrospect, they felt like, we waited too long with Knobloch, because very proud. And was very upset about how, and so for the first year, it felt like that he was in denial about dealing with it. So I hope Jose is talking with somebody as he works through it. One thing I heard from Astros people when I asked about the team was, our rotation is a lot better than what people, could be a lot better than what people think. What do you see in that group?
I see a thin group, not thin on talent, but thin on experience. And there's a real drop-off. When you talk about, okay, Framber Valdez hurt his ring finger a couple of weeks ago, and that was a big blow. He was their best pitcher last year. And when you think about, okay, everybody else slots up a little bit. Greinke's the opening day starter. Then it's McCullers, and then it's Urquidy, Javier. Then the fifth starter, I don't think Odorizzi's going to be ready, because he hasn't pitched in a game yet this spring. So if he pitches maybe 10 days into the season or 8 days, whatever it is, misses a start or two or a rotation or two to get back in there, you're looking for somebody, and that's probably Luis Garcia at this point. The real gold on any staff, and I think it's going to be across the major leagues, are the guys who can go one-plus innings. It's the middle relievers this year, especially in the early going, to keep everybody's innings down. And to be able to cover these innings, Brent Strom said something famously this offseason. He said, if every one of my pitchers had a 30% jump in innings pitched this season compared to last year, I'm still 400 innings shy. And what do you do? Where do you get that?
Wow.
So everybody's going to have to use a lot of starters. The Astros are going to have to use a lot of starters. They've got a lot of guys who haven't pitched 180 innings as a major league pitcher, let's face it. So they're going to have to dig deep. They're phenomenal at developing pitchers, Buster. They're unbelievable. The guys that we're starting to see at the mid and upper levels of their minor league system, the arms are ridiculous. I mean, just, I can't believe how many of them they keep throwing out there. But it's real. They've figured out a little formula, and they draft guys on spin and all of these things, and they come out there, and I think they get to the big leagues pretty quickly. We saw 10 debuts as pitchers last year, and for the most part, they all held their own.
We got about a minute left. I want to ask you who you view as the Astros' primary competition in the American League West, because as I talked about in the podcast yesterday, I'm starting to buy the Angels hype a little bit. What about you?
I'm buying the Angels hype. I really am. And I think Jose Quintana in the rotation, they've got a new closer with Iglesias, I think matters a lot. And they've been brutal as far as pitching goes the last few years. So they need Griffin Canning, and they need some guys to step up, Andrew Heaney and some of these guys to step up to be contenders. I still think it's Oakland and the Astros at the top with the Angels just a few games behind them. So, but I think it's a three-team race. And I think with an injury or two, and we've talked about the lack of depth that the Astros currently have right now, I think the Oakland A's, they never have enough money to go get a free agent if they have somebody get hurt. It's that type of situation that could put the Angels right there in the mix should some of the depth issues be challenged with the Astros and the A's.
All right, when you go on your run with Tony Robbins tomorrow, and he says something really profound, please jot it down and send me a text, okay, Sparks?
I will. You got it. You need all the help you can get. I understand.
Thank you.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, boys. Bleacher Tweets for Wednesday. And when I say boys, I mean Tim Kirkshin. We have him on the line to settle our bet from last week. We did not get to, the official finish line of our Royals bet that revolved around our pal Tim Kirkshin. So I'm going to play some sound here, and then we will get Tim's verdict.
Well, let's set it up. Let's set up what the bet was. Just for those who don't know, our bet the day after the Royal interview that Oprah Winfrey had, I mentioned at the top of the show, I had a question going into the production of the show that day about whether or not Tim would have an awareness of what took place. And so I mentioned this to Taylor, and so we built a bet around that. And this was the conversation we had at the top of the podcast. I'm going to ask Tim whether or not he's aware of what was said in the Oprah bombshell interview with Harry and Meghan last night. What's going to be your guess about that?
Oh, there's simply no chance that he knows anything about Harry and Meghan Markle and the Royals.
So that was the bet. But then there, and, Tim talked about, how he ingested the information from that interview. But then there was a question, I think, among some of the listeners about whether or not I actually won the bet. I thought I won the bet. And then there was some pushback. And in the end, I wound up deciding, you know what? Let Tim decide. Let Tim decide if that bet, who won that bet. So that's why we had to bring Tim back to ask that question.
All right. So I have to answer the question?
Yes.
All right. Taylor wins the bet.
Yes.
What? Oh, my God.
Buster, the question you asked me initially was, did I watch the interview? And I told you I watched the NBA All-Star game instead because Steph Curry and Dame Lillard were making shots from half court. I told you the only king I watched that night was LeBron James. So Taylor wins. I do have a working knowledge of this by what I read the next day, but if I didn't watch it, that means I have no working knowledge. Look, I know way more about Prince Fielder than I do about Prince Harry, okay? But everybody knows it's hard to live in the royal family. Everyone knows that.
Okay. Now we have to go to the tape again.
Oh, my God.
I got to find out what the first question I asked it, Tim, because that's not how I remember it. But that's how you remember it, Tim?
That's how I remember it. Play the tape.
I mean, obviously, Tim declared me the victor, so I'm partial on this. But I think you initially asked, did he watch the interview? And then you, Buster, you dug deeper on it. And you were like, oh, and that's how we got to Tim saying that, oh, I read something about it. I'm aware of what was going on. So,
it's so funny. I feel like a lawyer who's doubling back on my appeals. I'm just going up from level to level to level. But now I am sincerely curious about the question, because if what Tim said is exactly right, that I asked, my first question was whether or not he watched, then absolutely, then that decision's right. But I have my questions, Tim.
Right. So there are two parts to this. Answering the question, I did not watch it. Do I have a mild working knowledge of the royal family? Yes, I do. And what happened in that interview, but only because I read about it the next morning, not because I watched it live.
So shocked by the decision. I'm throwing down my clipboard and I'm walking out.
This is on you, Buster. You set up the bet one way and then you ask the question the other.
Oh, wait a second. Taylor, you just said last week you thought I won the bet in retrospect, and now you're doubling back on that?
Yeah, because Tim has brought to light information that I previously did not recall. So,
oh, my goodness. Tim, you're dismissed.
All right. Thank you. I hope I didn't cause any real problem between you two.
That's it.
There's a rift.
The podcast is done.
All right. We'll go to the tweets. Thanks for...
I don't know if I can go on.
Well, you did a better job of setting the whole thing up than I did, so you've got a producer's career in you yet. Let's go to Andrew DeSalvo at DeSalvotion. He writes in, put these three in order from soonest to happen to longest time away from happening. Major League Baseball moves the mound back several feet. Major League Baseball permanently moves all games to seven innings and the 2027 World Series. Which happens soonest?
2027 World Series happens first. The MLB permanently moves all games to seven innings would happen second. And I don't think they'll ever move the mound back. I think they'll make adjustments with the rules in the use of starting pitchers before they would move the mound back.
Alrighty. And last one for today, Stephen Otley at Stephen Otley writes in, we know there's lots of shortstops hitting the market next offseason. What do you think the demand will be like? How many teams will A, need a shortstop, and B, be willing to pay top dollar?
Yeah, we've talked about how on the player side, there are a ton of great shortstops potentially going to be available. Francisco Lindor, if he doesn't sign a long-term deal, Carlos Correa, Corey Seager, Javier Baez, and there's one other as well that I'm forgetting. But they're five elite guys. And then when you look at the teams that could be out there looking for shortstops, the Giants need a long-term solution at shortstop. The Texas Rangers need a long-term solution. Oh, Trevor Story is the fifth. And I think the Rangers are going to be all over Trevor Story during the upcoming offseason. The Yankees, the Mets, the Phillies, the Red Sox, if they decide at some point they want to move Xander Bogaerts to another spot, the Dodgers would have to decide what to do at shortstop if Corey Seager left, the Cubs, the Astros. If you're one of those guys, then you're probably feeling pretty good about your chance of getting paid if you have a good 2021. Carlos Correa's got to show that he can stay healthy. I think Trevor Story's got to have a big year. Javier Baez has got to demonstrate he's more consistent. Francisco Lindor, you know, needs to have a good season if he doesn't sign a long-term deal. So that absolutely is going to be at the top of the conversation when we get to the fall.
Alrighty, that does it for Bleacher Tweets. Hashtag Bleacher Tweets on Twitter. And please follow, rate, and review this podcast wherever you listen to your podcasts.
I can't believe Tim's decision. I'm so bitter.
That's review more today. Tape.
My thanks to Dave, Hembo, Steve. No thanks to Tim. No thanks to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe. And remember, hate and inequality based on skin color is something that we need to fight against every single day.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, check out the Fantasy Focus podcast wherever you listen to podcasts. The Baseball Tonight podcast.